Hey guys, it's Gabe. I just want to give a quick little announcement before the episode here. The day that this episode's going up, April 18th, is my beautiful wife Lisa's birthday. So Lisa, if you ever listen to this, which you probably won't, I just want to say I love you, and I hope you have a wonderful birthday, and I hope that you are happy, even though I won't let you have a segment on the podcast where you sing and talk about our dog. So anyway, enjoy the episode, everybody. Welcome to Interparty Conflict, the podcast where we answer your questions so you can have the best tabletop gaming experience possible. My name is Gabe.
And I am Jeff.
And we're going to answer your questions today. But first, I have a question for you, Jeff.
Oh, for me?
How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good.
Cool.
Just got a new car. I'm very excited.
That's pretty cool. And you used to have a big truck, right?
Yeah, moved from a truck to a very tiny little car, and it's taking some getting used to, but...
That's pretty inconsiderate, Jeff. How are you going to help people move?
Well, at least now I don't have to, like, go way in the back of a parking lot to park, because, like, in a big truck, like, I don't like to be, like, as a truck driver, I hated being the guy that, like, took up four spaces or, yeah. You know, scratched up somebody's car because he, you know, was trying to fit into too small of a space. So I always parked in the back, and I got used to walking, you know, the full length of a parking lot.
Yeah.
Now I can fit in anywhere now. It's great.
That's pretty cool. When I was in high school, I went to school with a kid that he had a nice car. So he took up four spaces, not because he had to, because he didn't want anybody to hit his car with their doors.
But then when you take up four spaces, you kind of invite people to mess with your car.
You know what I hate? I hate when you get to a parking lot, the only spot is right next to the person who parked really badly. So you have to park really badly. And then when you get back to their car, they've left.
Yes.
So you look like the car.
Yes. I hate that so much.
It's the worst.
Yeah, because it's just like, oh, you just look like the jerk who parked weirdly. It's like, no, that was the only spot that was available. It was next to... No, you know what? Never mind.
Yeah. So there are some, before we get into the episode, there's some things that I've been meaning to plug on the podcast for a little while.
Yeah, here on Car Talk.
I have a good friend named Tom, who apparently is my cousin.
What?
When I was in high school, I never...
This is the Tom we played,
yes,
we played with.
Yes, this is the Tom that we played with. He went to the same high school as us.
Uh-huh.
And he graduated right before I started going there. Mm-hmm. But all of his friends were like my friends. We all had the same friends. And all of them, they told me, hey, you know, you should meet this guy Tom. And they told him, hey, you should meet this guy Gabe. We never actually met each other until after Lisa and I moved to Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
I came back one time, like, just visiting. And I think at the time I was selling Cutco. I'm sorry, everybody. I'm really sorry. But I was – anyway, I met him. I also sold him a knife. I do feel kind of guilty about that. But I met him. We have a lot in common. We became friends. And then I found out he is my cousin through marriage twice.
Oh.
His family married into Lisa's family.
Okay.
And then I'm married to Lisa. So.
Oh, my. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. But so I wanted to mention he has a website. He makes board games.
Mm-hmm.
His board games are kind of a specialty type of game. They tend to deal with like history and or business stuff.
Okay.
It's not really stuff that I personally am interested in, to be perfectly honest. I feel bad, but he's made several games and he's going to keep making more. So I wanted to talk about him. I actually put his website into the show notes for last week. I don't know if anybody saw it, but I just want to bring it up again. His website is called Hollenspiel. I'll put it in the show notes again for anybody who wants to look at it.
But Hollenspiel.
Yes. It is Hollandspiele. Hollenspiel. Just how it sounds. So I'll put that in the show notes. So check that out. He also has a podcast that kind of goes along with that, where he and his wife Mary talk about like upcoming releases. And their website, I think, is just called like the Tom and Mary Show.
That's great.
So yeah, I'll put a link to both of those in the show notes. So check those out if you get a chance, because they're nice people. And
yes.
they are
love Tom and Mary.
They're hard workers. They do what they love doing. I also wanted to plug a blog of a good friend of mine as well. His name is Jake, and his blog is onepluckytoken.com. Mm. It's for his game that he's doing, and you know, just anything gaming related that he wants to put up. So if anybody wants to check that out, I'll put that in the show notes too. He's a good guy. I like to think that I only associate with good guys. So So, yeah. Now, Jeff, I want you to roll a d20. Don't get that one that kept rolling threes.
Right. I'm trying to avoid that one.
Now, you have just encountered a red dragon.
Oh, gosh.
However, it hasn't killed you outright. You have a chance to try and talk it down. So I want you to make a persuasion check.
This happens every week. I got a 10.
Okay. And let's say your modifier is a plus 4. You're a charismatic person. Okay. Well, you have managed to convince the dragon not to kill you.
Okay.
However,
mm-hmm.
you have to give him a piece of treasure in exchange for your life. And you know where that treasure is going to go?
I think I have an idea.
Where?
The dragon's hoard.
Ah! All right. So the item for today was submitted by my brother Ted. I recently saw my family this weekend. I probably should have mentioned that in our little section where we talk about what happened this week.
Sure.
But it's from my brother Ted, who is he used it in his game. He gave it to his players. It is an item called the nesting bag. He called it the Russian nesting bag, but you may not be playing a game of D&D where Russia is a place. Mm-hmm. So, or maybe Russia is a person.
Oh, sure.
The name of the person that invented it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's go ahead and call it the Russian nesting bag.
Yeah, she's probably a mother as well.
Yes. So the Russian nesting bag is a bag. It's a magical bag that functions as a bag of holding, but also has the special quality of holding or producing up to 4 copies of itself. All copies share the same interdimensional space, but require a proximity of 60 feet for it to function. Should any of the bags leave that proximity, the interdimensional space, the magic stays with the majority, and the isolated bag becomes a non-magical bag until it returns within that radius, and the existing number of bags has not exceeded 4. So you wouldn't be able to, like, take one out, bring one in, and then bring the original one in and now have 5. Doesn't work that way. But if an equal number of bags separate at the same time, you randomly determine which set keeps the space.
Gotcha.
So basically, you have a shared bag of holding amongst the whole party.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really cool.
I think that is really cool. He was telling me that he thinks that it encourages players to use the resources they have.
Right.
Because if one person has a particular item and you don't think they're ever going to use it, if they're the type of person that likes to make a tea and cakes check, shall mm-hmm. we say, then you can use it because at least it'll be putting it to use.
Sure.
Now, of course, you probably wouldn't want to put anything in the bag that you don't want other players to use.
Right.
But it still could definitely be useful. If nothing else, it could just save on bookkeeping.
Right. For sure. It's not like, yeah, who has what, you know, oh, didn't we pick up a potion of healing? Who had the potion of healing? Oh, the guy who's dead. The
guy's dead, exactly.
The
yeah.
guy who's on the floor. Shoot.
Yeah.
Well, okay, well, take it out of his pocket. All right, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, this is kind of neat. This reminds me a lot of, I don't know if people play, well, a lot of people play Minecraft, but in particularly modded Minecraft where there are things. I guess in regular Minecraft there is the Ender Chest where I think any Ender Chest you come across has the same inventory in it. But there's a mod in Minecraft where there's these pouches that, like, they're color-coded, and if you have the same coded bag, it accesses the same, you know, items within that bag. So you can basically you know, two people with the same code bag can, like, give each other stuff, like, from, you know, long distance. But although this is a shorter distance, but it does have some uses for, like, you know, larger parties that, you know, you don't have to, you know, remember who has what.
Yeah, yeah.
Or have to really decide who has what because you just throw it in the bag and say, okay, we have 4 potions.
Anybody who wants them can,
yeah, when,
you know, when if you need one, take it out.
Yeah, if you need it, use it.
Yeah. Yeah, in with a longer range, I think it does really work in Minecraft. I never got too far into Minecraft, but I played with you and our friend Steven
mm-hmm.
a bit. And, yeah, there would be times where, like, we would all be in complete opposite directions, you know, building yeah. stuff or mining or whatever. And then if one person needed something and they were all the way over there, you didn't have to go all the way over there.
Yeah.
You just put it in the bag, and now they have it.
Sure, yep.
Yeah, so I just think it's a really neat, it's a really simple item.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the text is just there to stop it from being abused, so you can't, like, you know, get more bags attuned to the space or whatever.
I think a cool addition to this might be, like, just to give it a little extra would be if you are far away from the collective mm-hmm. of bags, it is a normal bag, but you can maybe like once per day put one item in there.
Ooh, that's a good idea.
And that could be any, so if, from anything to like a treasure to or to a message. You know,
yeah,
like you could put a message, like a message in this bag, and you know it'll get to the rest of your party or something like that.
Yeah, I really liked in the Harry Potter series in Order of the Phoenix, I think it is. There's a point where Hermione, she gives everybody a coin
that
she has enchanted so that if she needs to send a message to them, she changes her coin and then it makes all of the other coins change similarly.
Yeah, it's for Dumbledore's army, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I forget if she did that specifically for Dumbledore's army or had something to do with Spew. I can't remember.
I don't think it had to do with Spew.
Yeah, no, I don't. But I know she like got the idea from like the Death Eaters, the dark mark
yes,
on her arm.
She did.
That's where she got the idea for it. But then she's like, well, let's do it on a coin and not on our skin.
Yeah. And then maybe like there could be, this wouldn't necessarily work in a game, but maybe in like a story or something where like one of the members of the party they think is dead, like fell into a volcano or something. And then one day they look in their bag and there's a note from them.
Right. Yeah. There's like, yeah, something that wasn't there before that like, was like wait. Wasn't this so-and-so's? Like,
yeah.
That'd be kind of neat.
Yeah. So I think there's definitely some cool potential to be had there.
Yeah, I like it.
Cool. You want to go ahead and get into some questions?
Sure. Let's do it.
Cool.
So our first question comes from Fingers Fate on Facebook, and he asks, what are some tips for designing custom magic items for your players?
So the tips that I can give are just kind of general things. Then I'll talk about some magic items that I gave you guys.
Sure.
As far as making them for your group, I would say try and keep in mind what your party's weaknesses are and try to engage each player in the area that you think they'll respond to the strongest. So like if you have a fighter in the group who, let's say you have a fighter in the group that he doesn't really interact with the party very much except when they're like at a tavern or something.
Mm-hmm.
You could give that fighter a magic item that maybe like lets him create an endless supply of alcohol. And that way he has a way to engage the other players in a role playing sense that he normally could only do in certain situations.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, one kind of an idea, like look at something that you think the player might benefit from mechanically or thematically.
Right.
And give it to them. If you can think of a way to make a character awesome in one specific way, then giving them a custom item is a good way to do that. I guess let me get into some examples.
Okay.
So I was running the Age of Worms a bunch of years ago. I know. Really? Really, Gabe? Because I only mention that every episode. there's a point in the Age of Worms adventure path where the players get a piece of the Rod of Seven Parts, which is this big time artifact in Greyhawk.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have the opportunity to give it. So that they meet a really powerful archmage. The adventure gives them an option to give it to him for safekeeping because earlier in that adventure, they were attacked because somebody knew that they had it.
Mm-hmm.
So the adventure says, now that the players know that having this artifact could make them a target, they have the option to give it to this really powerful archmage, this good aligned archmage, for safekeeping. But because they're giving up a really powerful artifact, the adventure says, if you're going to do this, be sure to give your players some sort of powerful magic item in exchange.
Sure.
And then it says, if you want to, the archmage can like cast spells or whatever to alter the magic item's appearances so that they fit more with your character. So if your character wants like, I don't know, if he wants like a cloak of resistance, it'll be colored like with his color scheme or something like that.
Right.
I, however, took this to heart. I started running this campaign about the time that issue came out. So I knew that this was coming. I knew this was going to be coming when I started the campaign. So early on, I started doing my homework
right.
for this. When we were doing this, the three players that, Meg played with us for a little bit. Basically,
sure.
it was you, Jay, and Steve.
Mm-hmm.
I had introduced Jay to the game, so I knew pretty much all of the gaming that Jay had done. Like, all of Jay's gaming experiences, I had been there for.
Mm-hmm.
And then for you and Steve, you two had played together separately.
Yeah.
Then I had played with Steve a little bit, but mostly, like, I had heard little stories about what you guys did before you joined me and Jay.
Yeah.
I had heard that Steve once had a character that wielded an axe that he called the Axe of Bahamut.
Mm-hmm.
I think like his character's name was like something Bahamut or something.
I'm trying to remember if I can remember
it. Was like
it.
Danith Bahama, Bahama or something. Yeah. So I knew that he had this character that had an axe that it like looked like a dragon. Mm-hmm. And the way that he put it was anytime he rolled a natural 20, Bahamut would fly in and like breathe fire on everybody and it would do like a D100 damage.
We were really into Final Fantasy at this time. So the summons and everything from Final Fantasy were a big influence on our gaming.
Right. So I thought about that and I was like, you know, that's a really neat idea. And Steve's character in this campaign, in the Age of Worms campaign, was using an axe.
Right.
And so my mind was thinking, and the wheels were turning, and I was thinking to myself, like, okay, is there a way that I can give Steve's character the Axe of Bahamut from his previous campaign? So, like, I think I even got with you and asked, like, some specifics or something.
Right, I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, so, like, I you know, whatever I was able to get, I tried to keep that in mind. So I started thinking about that. Then as we got a little bit closer to the session in question.
Yeah.
I thought, okay, so I know what I'm going to do for Steve. What can I do for Jeff and what can I do for Jay? Now, I knew, similar to how I knew that that Steve's character had the Axe of Bahamut, mm-hmm. I had heard you talk about how you had a character who had an emerald sword. Because mm-hmm. I know you like the color green.
Right.
And I don't remember if your character used a sword, whatever the case.
He had a rapier and a great sword he'd use every once in a while.
Okay. So I knew that your previous character had used a long or used some sort of a sword that was emerald. What that meant, I didn't know. So I got with Steve. I didn't ask you, of course. Just like I didn't ask Steve about the Axe of Bahamut. I asked Steve what the emerald sword did, what abilities it had.
Yeah, I can't even remember exactly.
I don't think Steve really remembered. He just said like it had been passed down from a bunch of people and eventually your character got it. Because like your character at the time was from some nation that was like had like a whole lot of emeralds or something. And something so they like made that. A sword out of emerald.
Right.
And then I think he might have even said like if you got a critical hit, it like summoned a bunch of emeralds that you could sell or something. I don't think I'm forgetting that part.
I can't quite remember.
I don't know. But whatever the case, all I really had to go off of was that it had been passed down from a bunch of people and whatever. So I thought, okay, I can find some way to do something with that. And then I had an idea for what to do for Jay, which I sort of alluded to in the last episode, but I'll get to that in a minute. When it was coming time to, you know, I was really starting to prep that adventure. A few things had sort of changed. Steve's character, for example, like Steve had become really attached to the axe he was already using. Mm-hmm. That was partly from me and partly from him. So when Steve made his character was started off a barbarian, eventually became a cleric and was cleric for the rest of his gaming career. And so he had this axe. Steve's character wasn't the smartest bulb. He wasn't the brightest bulb in the box. He wasn't the smartest nail in the crayon box or whatever the expression is. He wasn't very smart. And so we had said that like whenever Steve wanted to spend a bunch of money to make a new magic item or like upgrade one of his magic items, because his character didn't really understand a lot of things, he didn't necessarily know to say, okay, excuse me, Mr. Spellcaster, I would like you to enhance this sword or this axe so that it is, you know, 25% stronger or whatever. There was a point early on where Steve wanted his axe to be adamantine, mm-hmm. but he liked having the axe that he had. He didn't like the idea of getting rid of it and getting a new axe. Mm-hmm. So I had an idea. His axe was magical by this point. He had made it +1 himself, I think. A big thing with Steve was that he'd like to eat things. There was one of the first adventures we did. You guys encountered like a magical fountain of gravy.
Right.
That, like it was a magical substance that you could eat a small amount and it would fill you up as if you ate for the day.
Yeah. I forgot that it was actually part of the adventure.
It was actually part of the adventure.
It was just a theme that carried on.
Yes. Yeah, so Steve's character had like a supply of this gravy.
Right.
And he would always be like eating it along with other things. And I think at one point he might have even like tried to feed some to his axe, you know, as a goof, of course. But I was like, you know, I can do something with this. So the way that I told Steve it happened was when the party went to a new town, I would say that Steve's character, his name was Shadowhand Silverbones. So Bones. I don't know why I said Shadow. So Bones went to some weapon place and he just kind of like handed them his axe and handed them a whole bunch of money and he said, make this stronger. And they were like, okay, sure, let me just set this down. Go, yeah, we'll get back to you in a couple days. And I don't know what they were planning on doing, but they set it down. on top of this pile of adamantine. They have just like a stack of adamantine
ingots or something.
So they leave. They come back a little while later, and the axe is there, but there's a big chunk taken out of the adamantine. And they're like, what the crap happened? And then they looked at the axe. Oh, and I forgot to mention, when Steve made his axe magical, I had described, he like put runes on his axe.
Right.
I had drawn out an axe, and then I drew a bunch of runes along the edge of the blade, and I had drawn it so that the runes looked like a mouth with a little tongue sticking out.
Basically, it was a smiley face.
Yes,
on the,
yes.
On the,
and so now, somehow the axe had become intelligent and had managed to eat some of the adamantine somehow or another.
Mm-hmm.
And so the adamantine left an adamantine mustache.
A milk mustache.
A milk mustache of adamantine on the blade. So basically, the edge of the blade was now adamantine so that Steve was able to overcome adamantine, you know, damage reduction with that weapon.
Sure, right.
So in keeping with that theme of Steve's axe being intelligent and eating things,
mm-hmm.
There was a later adventure. This was the adventure right before the players got the piece of the rotted seven parts.
Mm.
I think there was a time when I had to leave or something, or like I was going to be late. And so Jay actually offered to run the first encounter for me. That's really cool. I can't remember what the circumstances were. I could never imagine a player now offering to run an encounter for the DM.
Sure.
But he did it. And the encounter in question involved this big giant spider attacking the party. And at one point, Jay had the spider disarm Steve's character. It disarmed Bones, took Bones' axe, and then the spider attacked Bones with his own axe. Like it was holding the axe in its mouth.
Oh, right.
So the axe hit Bones. But the thing is, Steve's character, Shadow and Silver Bones, was always buffed up to high heaven. He had so many buffs on his character at any given time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I don't remember if this was my idea or Jay's idea or Steve's idea, but the axe being somehow partially intelligent after attacking Steve's character was like, that was delicious. not necessarily that Steve was delicious, but all of his buffs were like seasonings on the meat. And so his axe kind of started to turn against him just a little bit. So flash forward a little bit to when you guys meet the Archmage. You guys give the piece of the artifact to the Archmage, and he's like, okay, yeah, I'm gonna give you guys some treasure. I have some very powerful artifacts in my basement. Come with me and I will give each of you one, and you know, they'll be great.
Yes, he lured us into his basement
with promise of candy. So he takes you down there. He's like showing you, he's got all these trophies left and right. He's got, you know, like an iron golem's armor up, or like a mithril golem's armor up on the wall. He's got, you know, he's got like the eye of a beholder right here. He passes by, he has the head of a platinum dragon that's mm-hmm. like stuffed, and you know, it's like hanging on the wall.
Right.
And he's like super proud of this. He's like, you know, this thing, it was terrorizing a plane of whatever, we killed it and I got its head and it's right here. And so you guys are walking along, and then Shadowhand Silverbones, he's in the back, and suddenly like his axe starts like trying to wiggle itself out of its sheath. And he's like, what the heck? So he grabs it and he's looking at the axe, and the axe turns and looks at him, and the axe is hungry. And so he starts fighting with the axe. The axe is trying to attack him. He's fighting with the axe. He's swinging it around, and then chunk. He manages to stop it from attacking him, but he looks over and he realizes that he's swung the axe into the head of the platinum dragon.
Mm-hmm.
This priceless artifact he has just completely destroyed. It's got like this huge tear through it. And then the rest of the party, they hear something, they turn around, they're like, Bones, what are you doing? And he's like, I didn't. And he looks over and the platinum dragon head is gone. Instead, in his hand, his axe has eaten the platinum dragon head and has become part platinum dragon.
Sure.
So basically each thing that it eats makes it more powerful in some way. So like it ate the adamantine and became partly adamantine. Mm-hmm. Now it ate this platinum dragon and became part platinum dragon. Now the way that I decided this works. Oh, and so at this point, Steve realizes, wait a minute, you're telling me I have a platinum dragon axe that is the axe of Bahamut. And so like he realized that I had, completely unknown to him,
yeah,
I had found out that his character had an axe of Bahamut and I gave it to him.
Yeah.
And he was overjoyed.
Yes.
So what this did game mechanics wise, his character was already really, really good at doing a lot of damage. His character was all about, he would power attack. He would hit something and he would get a critical and do times three critical and just do a ton of damage. Mm-hmm. So I didn't necessarily want to just let him do more damage.
Right.
But I let him do something a little bit different with his damage. So what I did was, because I knew that he liked having the axe the way that it was, but I also wanted it to be this other axe. Because I think, if I'm not mistaken, the axe of Bahamut his previous character had like was intelligent, but was like, I don't know. It was intelligent in some way that his axe wasn't.
Right.
So basically, his axe had now transformed to the point where it could switch between being his normal axe, which had the stats of his normal axe. It was adamantine, times three critical, so on. Or he could switch it to being the axe of Bahamut, in which case it was exactly the same stat-wise, except anytime he got a critical hit, instead of doing triple damage to that one target, he could do single damage, whatever its normal attack damage would be, to every target within 20 feet.
Okay.
So instead of just doing a ton of damage to one person, he could do a normal amount of damage to everybody. And thematically, Bahamut swoops in and breathes fire or whatever. So,
and it's definitely a cool way to, like, because like giving your characters like special cool magical weapons, but then if they're already attached to the thing that they have, like, you know,
right,
like, and it's just different thematic ways to go about like upgrading your weapon. It's instead of just going up to the nearest magic weapon shop and being like, here's 30,000 gold, give me a +5.
Exactly, because you know, again, I hate the idea of someone handing over enough money to buy a castle for a marginal increase in their attack accuracy. It's it's so weird, and I try to get away from that as much as possible.
Yeah.
So, but the important thing here is that I understood that Steve was already really good at dealing damage. I didn't want to make him more powerful, at least not like inherently more powerful.
Right.
He could, in theory, do more damage if there were a lot of enemies. You know, the total amount of damage would be higher.
Right, yeah.
But he was...
In an average encounter, he's still doing the same amount of damage. Just
exactly.
Over.
If it was like a boss fight against one boss, he would actually be better off not using the item I got him.
Right.
But in other situations, it would be advantageous. So mm-hmm. I thought that was a good way to handle his. Now, I'm going to... Before I talk about what I did with your character, Jeff, I'll go and I'll talk about Jay's character.
Sure.
Jay's character was... He was playing a paladin slash monk who used two swords.
Mm-hmm.
And so his whole thing was he would get a whole bunch of attacks. And he was as much as your character was the jack of all trades, I think Jay's character in combat was kind of the jack of all trades.
Sure, yeah.
And Jay's character was already pretty powerful. I didn't necessarily want to give him anything that was going to make him more powerful, but he also already had a lot of options otherwise. So I was kind of at a loss what to do for Jay.
Mm-hmm.
But then in keeping with how I gave Steve something that was from his past character, I was going to be giving you something from your past character. So I decided, since Jay was now playing like explicitly a paladin,
mm-hmm.
I gave him Iron Claw.
Oh, right. Yeah.
The weapon that the item that I talked about in the last episode,
mm-hmm.
which was a lawful good gauntlet of rust that could heal. It could use an illusion. The powers didn't really fit very much, but thematically it did, and I knew that was an item that Jay would appreciate because Jay had it. He liked it on his previous character, and this one, it was even more in keeping with his character's values. So I gave that to Jay. I hope he appreciated it. I think he did.
Mm-hmm.
He got some use out of it. He used its powers and whatnot, and I like to role play it. But
yeah, having healing from the intelligent item healing is nice, just because it goes on its own. Goes on its own turn, basically.
And I don't think you guys had any ability to create illusions of any kind, and that was one of the things Iron Claw could do. It had like major image once per day or something.
Yeah.
So I do remember a couple specific times where Jay did get use out of that.
Yeah.
So you know, I hope he had a good experience with that. I thought it was funny giving him, you know, giving each of these guys something from their previous characters. But I mentioned in the last episode when Jay got his item, this guy, the archmage's name was Manzorian. He led you guys into another room where he had like a bunch of soundproof boxes.
Yeah.
Opened up one of them, and inside this soundproof box, he hears, "Are you righteous?"
Right.
And so now came to Jeff's character.
Uh-huh.
Jeff was playing a savant slash warlock.
This character was a disaster.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to pin down exactly what your character's focus was, if there was one.
There wasn't one. That's the idea, I think, because the savant was very all over the place. So I just didn't have a focus.
Yeah. So with Jeff's character, so I knew I wanted to somehow give him an emerald sword. I didn't really know what that would have been translated to. But here's what I did. So Jeff was playing a multi-class character. He had these two classes, and I think like because he was unhappy with Savants, then you switched over to being a part warlock.
Yeah.
And I remember at one point you were lamenting that you weren't ever going to be able to get any of the really high level powers that warlocks get because right. They get really cool stuff in third edition. They got really cool stuff at a high level.
Yeah.
But the thing is, because you were multi-class and because you didn't start taking warlock until you were like level 10 or something.
Yeah, I think it might have been
something like that. 10. Then you were never going to be able to get some of the abilities that were really cool.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, how can I let you do that? Because I would say mechanically your character was the weakest.
Sure.
It's not a problem. There's right. Not everybody can be the strongest. Not everybody can be, you know, the weakest, whatever. There isn't a best. All of them contributed at all times. And there were things your character did that nobody else could do.
Sure.
But so I'll get to that in a minute. So I thought, since Jeff is the mechanically the weakest character in the group, I felt no issues whatsoever with giving him the potentially most powerful item.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was the Archmage led you guys into this room where it was clearly like you'd gone through some sort of a portal or something. You were in this like mine where there were emeralds like poking out of the walls. You then went over, opened up this box, and inside was a longsword composed entirely of emerald.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what this meant was that while you had this sword had been passed down from generation to generation to generation. Everybody using it was some sort of a powerful hero, but they were all different. And they all used the sword for so long that the sword absorbed some of their memories and some of their abilities. So what that means is that while you have this sword, once you are like there wasn't attunement in that game, in that edition, but basically once you had the sword for more than like 24 hours, you would become attuned to it. At that point, whatever classes you had, you were counted as being 4 levels higher for purposes of what class abilities you had. In theory, that meant that if you were a character with a whole lot of different classes, you could become ridiculously powerful because that included spellcasting, that included class abilities. Mm-hmm. If you were a fighter, that would have included bonus feats. This is not something you'll find in a book because this was so ill-defined
right.
that it was so ripe for abuse. But I was giving it to a specific character in my group that I knew would get the experience out of it that I was hoping for.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, it's a nice way to make up for how terrible of a character I had.
Yeah. So basically your character now was 4 levels higher than he was, you know, for his hit points were the same as
right,
his
yeah.
Saves, whatever. Those were all whatever his actual level was. But you got warlock abilities as if you were 4 levels higher. You got savant abilities as if you were 4 levels higher, which meant that by the end of the campaign, you were just barely high enough level to get one of those top tier warlock abilities.
Right.
So again, I knew what Jeff's weaknesses were as a character, and I knew what the player wanted. So I was willing to give the character something that was extra powerful because I knew I mean, I knew I was in control of ultimate control of like what you guys did.
Mm-hmm.
So if I saw that it was too powerful, I could always dial it back. But I knew it wouldn't be because of the situation I put you in. And because I didn't want you to be tied down to using the same weapon all the time, because I think you said your character wasn't actually using a longsword.
Right.
You didn't have to be wielding it to get the effect. It just had to be in your possession. You like had to do something. You like had to have it with you at least once every day or something.
I think I eventually enchanted it so it like could... I forget the name of the enchantment, but it basically lets it turn into other weapons.
Yes,
and you like get the proficiency of that weapon or something like that.
I think so. Yeah, you eventually enchanted it so that number one, it could act as any alignment. It could act as any any material, and you enchanted it so that it could transform into any other weapon.
Right.
So basically, I made it so that no matter what, you could use this weapon to overcome any kind of damage reduction.
Mm-hmm.
You could do anything with it you wanted. Also, because you were a warlock, you eventually took an ability that let your Eldritch Blast basically overcome any kind of spell. It was immune to spell resistance, mm-hmm. and it wasn't even an elemental type. So basically, by the end of the campaign, Steve was a character that did a ton of damage in one hit.
Mm-hmm.
Jay's was the character that did a ton of damage over several hits.
Yeah.
Yours was the character that you didn't do a ton of damage, but there was literally nothing I could do to prevent that damage.
Right. It was just a basically constant guaranteed, and it was a ranged touch attack. My Eldritch Blast was a ranged touch attack. So
bypassed spell resistance, bypassed any elemental resistance.
That bypasses like armor and stuff. It's
because it was a touch attack.
Touch AC. So like, you know, unless they had a crazy high dex, which by the end we were fighting very large monsters. It was basically like, yeah, got me to the point where I was like, okay, I'm useful now. Hooray. I mean, I had other things because like my character was a warlock and like I could go invisible and
You could fly. Yeah, yeah.
All at will, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So there were a lot of like minor things your character could do. Mm. And there was definitely stuff that you excelled at. But again, overall, I think like your character was the weakest. So I was totally fine with giving you something that could have been abused, giving it to someone else.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't recommend giving. Yes. Just anybody an artifact. Yeah.
Giving any other spellcaster. Oh, cool. Now I can cast a wish at level 13.
Wish at will with no consequences.
Yeah. So overall, I would say that handing out these magic items, I'm so proud of how I did.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, I did research on the players.
Right.
To find out exactly what the players, you know, what I thought the players would want. And then I gave it to them in such a way that, like, I even tied in what their characters would, you know, would appreciate. Like, with Steve's character, like, I think it's hilarious how that turned out.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, you're looking at the, what the, yeah, you're looking at what the character needs, what the party needs, and what the player needs to feel more involved with the game and have a better time.
And, of course, I don't think every DM can go ahead and do this. Not every DM has been playing with his players for several campaigns.
Sure.
Maybe the players he's playing with haven't played in previous campaigns. And so I'm not saying that this is the only way to do it. I was just giving an example of how that might look in one group. If you just look at how the player plays the game, if you notice that a player is like using one of their abilities a lot, maybe you want to give them an item that either, number one, makes that specific ability better, mm-hmm. either more powerful or just more broad. Or you try to give them another ability that you think will complement that ability. You don't ever want to stop your players from using what they enjoy using. But if you can give them something that they want to use just as much, mm-hmm. then, you know, that's cool as well.
Yeah.
So look at what they do and try to either help it or complement it. And like I said, try to give each character an opportunity to be awesome. If you know that there's something upcoming in an adventure where like a bad guy is going to have a super weakness against something that the party doesn't have, give that to one of the players and then figure out some way to signpost that so that in the right moment they think to use it, because every player loves to do something cool.
Sure.
I've talked about the Adventure Zone in the past, the podcast, the fifth edition actual play podcast. The DM of that is so good at making the players feel like they're doing something awesome. He is always setting up encounters in such a way that, like, it'll be the perfect opportunity for one of the players to do something that he knows they can do and have them do it really, really well.
Mm.
So, yeah, just listen to your players, pay attention to your players and their play styles, and try to think up something that will accommodate that as much as possible.
As far as balancing the items, that's a whole other thing.
That is hard. If you haven't been playing for a long time, it can be really hard to balance custom magic items. But that's the great thing. You're playing with people. You're not playing with a computer. So if you give your player something and you see it's too powerful, do not just say, oh, someone stole it. Because that's going to make them so – that's not going to make anyone happy.
Right.
Instead, talk to the player and say, look, this is too powerful. I'm going to make it less powerful. Work with me. And let's find a way to make it less powerful that is still enjoyable for you.
Right, yeah.
Because, like, if I found out that an item I really liked was going to get nerfed, that would suck. But if I had an input on how it got nerfed, that would be so cool. Maybe, like, you tell the player, I'm going to take away this bonus, but I could give you this other minor ability in place. Mm-hmm. Something that you don't think will be powerful, but might give them just, like, a fun thing they can do.
Right, yeah.
So, like, if it's ever too powerful, you can talk to the players and just say, hey, look, I need to make this less powerful. If it's not powerful enough, oh, that's an even better problem.
Yeah.
Because then you can have, like, oh, my goodness, you just killed that bad guy with that sword. Now the sword's +3 instead of +2.
Yeah, like absorb the soul of a demon or something.
That was another thing in that same campaign. I had Jeff's character absorb a demon and then gain some powers from it.
Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah, that's another story for another time, though.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a lot of it is going to depend on exactly your players and your group. But again, the best advice I can give is to engage each player in an area that you think they'll respond to. Listen to them. Try to give them something that can make them feel awesome.
Mm-hmm. Next question comes from Nicholas P. Through email. And if you'd like to send us a question in the email, where can they send it, Gabe?
Well, they can send it to interpartyconflict@gmail.com. Yeah. That has no dashes, no spaces, all one word. Interpartyconflict.
So Nicholas P.'s email, he asks us, do you think a certain alignment lends itself to a certain personality?
I do, but I don't really know what I'm basing that off of.
Mm.
In my head, whenever I picture a lawful character, I picture them as being serious and, you know, like by the book. And whenever I think of like a chaotic character, I think of them as being like, whoa, I'm crazy. I'm chaotic. Yeah, whoa, right, let's do something crazy. But there's nothing really inherent to the alignment system that necessitates that.
Right. You always see like the people post pictures where it's like the alignment grid where it's lawful on top, chaotic on the bottom, neutral in the middle. And like it'll be a picture of a certain like archetype or it'll be like, you know, they'll do it like themed from different like shows or something like that. So basically, you know, picture like the characters we were talking about Harry Potter earlier, the characters from Harry Potter, but arranged in this grid of based on their alignment. And like so like you do see certain like personalities and characters in those roles, and it makes sense because it's like, okay, that's kind of the idea of the alignment system. But I almost feel like sometimes alignments are more of an excuse for a character to act a certain way.
Yeah, I think the sentiment going around the 5th edition Facebook group is that chaotic neutral is the worst alignment for a character to play, because whenever somebody plays a chaotic neutral character, they just do whatever the heck they want.
Right.
But they have the defense of, I'm not evil, I'm chaotic neutral.
Right, yeah, I'm just neutral.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean,
I play by my own rules.
It's always hard to define exactly what alignment should or shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
But
we've talked about alignment before.
We have, yeah. But it doesn't have to, like, it doesn't have to lend itself to a certain type of personality.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I think that whenever I picture a chaotic character, they have that, whoa, crazy thing. And whenever I picture a lawful character, they're like stoic and serious, but that doesn't have to be the case. And I can definitely acknowledge that.
In 5th edition, are there mechanics, based on alignment?
As far as I can tell, no.
Okay.
It is purely role-playing based. Anything that was like, there isn't a detect evil. Instead, what paladins get is they basically like detect undead and demons and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think they can like detect outsiders maybe.
Yeah,
like
yeah. And I think...
It depends on their oath, I think.
I think so, yeah. And I think in Pathfinder, I think there is alignment-based mechanics in that. But I remember there being a class that gets an ability that's like detect guilt.
Huh.
Which I think is a really interesting concept.
Yeah.
That would be really cool.
Well, I mean, like everybody feels guilt for something. Well, I mean,
there's specifics to it.
Well, right. But I think that like because so many like people have guilt in one way or another, it could be something small like, oh, shoot, I forgot to take out the trash today. And I told them I'd take out the trash. Shoot. You know, or somebody who killed a guy, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, it could be a cool little story thing where, like, this person has this ability to detect guilt, but, you know, like, you know, how do you define the levels of guilt that's worth, you know, pursuing?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because, like, it's always a problem when somebody thinks that just because a character is evil, that means that they're guilty of something, and they're not.
Yeah, detect evil is not a license to go around killing anybody who glows red when you use it. You
know? Like, in real life, I guarantee you, probably about a third of the people that you meet are evil. That doesn't mean that they have killed someone or stolen something. It doesn't even mean that they want to do either of those things. Might just mean that they're a dick. So
you just, you know, just don't hang out with them.
right. So it's always hard to define things like this. And so I don't know. I don't really have anything to base my opinion off of whether it lends itself to a certain alignment or not.
Yeah, it's kind of like just falling into like stereotypes and things like that.
So I guess,
it's
just
like, yeah, it's like you're expecting something of those alignments.
Yeah,
and, you know, like there's always the idea of a paladin who's lawful good and who's just like, you know, goes around smiting evil and saying no to the rogue anytime the rogue, you know, tries to do something roguish.
Yeah. I think it's a couple things that I think are interesting about alignment is that, so like, I remember when the Deities and Demigods book came out for third edition, I remember thinking that, you know, they have the alignments, or they have the stats for all sorts of deities. Like they've got the Greyhawk deities in there. They've got the Greek deities, they've got the Egyptian deities, the Norse deities. And I remember thinking to myself, like, oh yeah, the Greek deities, they're probably all chaotic, aren't they? Because like, that's how I picture the Greek gods, because they're always just, they're so at the mercy of their emotions and whatnot.
They're very, they're all over the place doing their own thing.
But
messing with people.
Right. As you would expect, though, they're not all chaotic, because if that was chaotic, if every god was chaotic, that would mean that, well, in that world, all the people are chaotic. And then if everybody, that doesn't work if everybody's the same alignment, then that's not how the alignment system works. But basically, it kind of showed me that even if they all kind of come off as chaotic, that's just because that type of mythology lends itself more to people of a chaotic mindset. So basically, it doesn't mean that the gods are all chaotic, but it means that the people interpreting the stories might be. But within that chaos, some of them are more lawful, some of them are less lawful, and so on. Mm-hmm. I was recently listening to a podcast. I mentioned the Dicey Tales podcast on here before. It's an actual play podcast. They have the people that make that have another podcast called College of Lore, which they just started. They only have a few episodes and they only update like once a month, I think. But that podcast is all about fifth edition rules. And each episode, they choose like a specific category of rules. One of the episodes was about alignment. So they were talking about different alignments. They were talking about examples of different alignments. It's a very, very good podcast. I'll put it in the show notes. But in their alignment episode, one of the guys on there brings up a very interesting point. A lot of the D&D books refer to Robin Hood as being chaotic good. That's like the example. Oh, you steal from the rich, you give to the poor.
Sure.
And I guess on some level, that concept of steal from the rich, give to the poor, I guess makes sense as chaotic good. You're fighting against tyranny.
Right.
Chaotic good is all about freedom, and you're giving to the poor. You're doing something good with what you're doing.
Yeah.
But they brought up a very good point on this podcast that actually, if you read the stories about Robin Hood, he is not chaotic good.
Mm.
He is specifically rebelling against evil government. So basically, he is doing exactly what needs to be done to combat the government that is in place.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that he's stealing from the rich just because. He's stealing from the rich because that is the solution to the problem.
Sure.
And in some of the stories, as they pointed out on this podcast, some of the stories about Robin Hood, once because he used to be friends with the king, and then that king left, and now the king that's in place is the one that's evil. When the king that he's friends with came back, Robin Hood offered himself up to be executed because he knew that the things he had done were wrong. He did them because he had to do them.
Right.
But he knew they were wrong, and now he's paying for them. So in other words, he is straight up lawful good.
Sure.
He's lawful good in a chaotic world.
Gotcha.
So I think this is all just evidence that alignment is a very nebulous thing that's hard to tie down. If you can come up with a reasonable explanation for any alignment to do anything, I say that should be allowed.
Mm.
You know, because it's so much of it is up for interpretation. And anytime a DM enforces something based on alignment, I think that they've taken it a bit too far.
Right. Yeah, because the limitations of alignment in like the older editions were like you had to be lawful good to play a paladin.
Yeah.
You had to.
Not only that, in addition to being lawful good, you had to like abide by a bunch of rules as well.
Right.
Because a lawful good person can lie if they have to. They can, you know, hurt someone if they have to. A lawful good paladin, though, in third edition, you couldn't lie.
Right.
If you just couldn't do it.
Yeah. If you did stuff that went against your alignment and your code, like
lost all your powers.
Yeah. You'd become a very ineffective character.
Yes. You'd become a fighter without bonus feats.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not like the paladin was like that much more stronger than any of the other classes to, you know, to make that, you know, it's like, wow, you're putting this like very short leash on this character for, you know, what equates to like, you know, the same power and class of anybody else. Well, I guess we can't really count like the monk, because the monk was just so bad.
Yeah, the monk was pretty bad.
Did they Did Monk have the good saves at third edition?
They had all good saves, but like they didn't have very many hit points. No. They couldn't wear armor, so they weren't gonna I'm sorry, but they didn't belong in the front lines.
No, and like their attacks weren't great.
If they wanted to be good at fighting, they had to put their highest stat in strength, which meant that they weren't going to be able to make use of the myriad abilities that use wisdom.
Right, that's true.
So yeah, monks were to put it in fourth edition terms, they were very mad. Multiple ability dependent.
Oh, sure.
And sorry, this is a side tangent here, but I've heard people say that like, oh my goodness, how powerful would your character be if you had all 18s? And I just want to say, if you had all 18s, your character actually would not be significantly more powerful than they already are. And here's why. If you're playing whatever class you're playing, mm-hmm. you're already going to put your highest ability score in your stat that you're going to use the most.
Right.
If you have a high stat in a stat in an ability score you don't use, it's not really that big of a deal. Let's say you have a fighter. You have an 18, you're going to put it in strength. If you have an 18, you put it in con. Okay, that's pretty good too.
Yeah.
If you have an 18 in wisdom, you're not that much more powerful than a fighter that doesn't have an 18 wisdom.
Right.
A little bit.
Yeah, you still get like bonus to like spot and stuff like that. Yeah. So that's nice.
But you're not like two levels higher. No, you have a higher spot and your will save is a little bit higher. And that bonus is going to get less pronounced as you go up in levels because everything else is going to go up in levels too. So, and then similarly, if you're a wizard, sure, you might be able to benefit from an 18 strength, but are you going to? If you have an 18 strength, are you going to get into melee combat? Probably not.
Yeah.
So what does it matter if you have an 18? Is an 18 strength wizard that stays out of melee combat any more powerful than 18 than a 10 strength wizard that stays out of melee combat?
Yeah.
Not really. A little bit, but not really. The only classes that really would benefit from having an 18 in every stat are the classes that are dependent on many different ability scores, like the monk.
Oh, Paladin was like that too.
And Paladin, yeah. Who are regarded as the weaker classes in virtually every edition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, that's going to depend on the edition. In fifth edition, maybe Paladins are a little bit better. I don't know. But like, especially in third edition, an all 18s monk is actually going to be a playable character.
Right.
Whereas a non all 18s monk is not.
Yeah.
An all 18s fighter is just a fighter that has a couple higher skills.
Right.
That's it. It's not that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as I said, as you go up in levels, it's just going to be even less pronounced.
Sure.
A level 20 character, it matters so much less whether they have an 18 or a 16 or a 14.
Yeah, because by then you have abilities and magic items and stuff to make up for those stats anyway.
You have so many other things that are going into making your character good
mm-hmm.
that... it's not that big a deal. Yeah. Anyway, well, I think that'll just about do it for today.
Okay.
So if anybody wants to submit items and questions, please email us at interpartyconflict@gmail.com. For show notes, a running list of questions asked and important links, or to download the episode, go to interpartyconflict.blogspot.com. Also, I should probably mention, I put a list of all of the Dragon's Horde items on the blog, on the Blogspot site.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's, I put a little... link on the right side. So anytime someone wants to see the stats of a Dragon's Horde item, go to our show notes or go to our subreddit. They are on both of those.
Cool.
Because I've had, within the last couple of weeks, I've had multiple people ask me, hey, where can I see the stats of X item? Do I just need to pay really good attention to the episode?
Oh.
I mean, you can. You can go back and re-listen anytime you want. But if you want just a quick and easy list, go ahead and put them on there. And if anybody wants to make any fan art of any of the items,
sure,
feel free. The guy that submitted the Cube of Patience,
uh-huh.
It's a physical die that he has.
Oh, cool.
So he sent in a picture of that. So I have a picture of the actual Cube of Patience. Find us on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/interpartyconflict or go to our subreddit at reddit.com/r/interpartyconflict for weekly discussion questions from me. We're also on Twitter at @InPartyConflict. And we're on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and YouTube. Please rate, review, and subscribe. We really appreciate it. And our music is made by Boxcat Games from Nameless, the Hackers RPG. So, Jeff, roll a dexterity save.
Okay. Oh, I got a 14.
You needed a 15. You're dead.
Oh.
See you next time.
Bye.